Hello, welcome. The first time I opened one of Andy Mozina's books, I thought I'd read just one story, or maybe only a part of a story. The book was Quality Snacks, Mozina's second collection and a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Prize. And what I discovered is that you can't read just part of a Mozina story and not want more. And so I read one story, and then more, and marveled at how real Mozina's work feels, how he balances searing humor with lingering solemnity. Mozina connects the craft of a writer's work to the world. Fiction, as we know, is constructed from both artifice and verisimilitude. Nowhere are those two possibilities, artifice and verisimilitude, better combined than in Mozina's work, where in one story, a teenage boy tries to balance his role as caregiver for his sick mother with the pressure and the temptation to participate in an outrageously risky activity with a friend. When, in one scene, the boy plugs a humidifier in for his mother, Mozina writes, "Maybe she just liked the sound of the steam, like the sound of wind through a loose window. Maybe to her, it was like the sound of a man breathing." Mozina's use of the simile is brilliant. He employs it to help us see the world. In another story, he writes, "An air conditioner punched out a window like a Pez in mid-dispense." And in another, he writes, "My step was light, no louder than grains of sugar stirred in a metal canister." Andy Mozina's similes are little stories within his stories. To read them is to notice the world in a new way. You'll find these wild delights in his other books, too. In his first collection, The Women Were Leaving the Men, which won the Great Lakes Colleges Association New Writers Award, and in his debut novel, Contrary Motion, which the New York Post declared a must read. Andy Mozina is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College. His fiction has appeared in numerous magazines and journals, including Tin House, McSweeney's, and Missouri Review. It's an honor and a pleasure to have him here at Michigan State University, and I want to thank the English Department for sponsoring this event, and the Michigan Writers Series for helping make that possible, and Diane from Everybody Reads back here, who has a stack of his debut novel back there, Contrary Motion. Welcome, Andy Mozina.
My daughter had a hot mic issue last night at her high school rehearsal for The Wiz. She was Glenda the Good Witch. And she was supposed to be carried out during her performance by some guys, and they didn't show up, and her wig fell off and her thing. And so after she did her song, she ran off the stage, dropping F-bombs and cussing everybody out, and she had a hot mic on. So if I get a little nervy here, it's because I don't want to do what have that experience that she had. You hate that. And I don't often get to wear a microphone that travels with me, so I may make that mistake after the reading, so just excuse that. Okay, I was going to read from the novel, which is about a harpist taking a symphony audition. And after the events of 11/8, I decided that I would read a new story. Does that sound okay? Okay. First of all, I want to thank Michael, and I'm not excluding you. I'm just sort of, because a lot of people are over here. Yeah, yeah. I want to thank Cindy and Robin for hosting me here, and thank you, Cindy, for that wonderful introduction. I've never had such a thoughtful introduction. Sincerely, I mean, I really mean that. So thank you. I won't do this anymore because there's a mic there. Okay. And thank you all for coming out tonight. So I'm just going to read one story, and that ought to do it. Truther. En route to the protest downtown, Jerry Helb was having confusing emotions because of outstanding Karen. He trudged down the sidewalk carrying four Xerox copies of the 9/11 Commission report and four copies of NIST's final report on the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, a lot of paper, heavy. A line of sweat ran from his balding temple into his mostly gray beard. He had duly performed his 7:30 a.m. echocardiogram, and then, taking some personal time he had requested months in advance, ducked out of his office at Bronson Cardiac Care, bearing the discredited government propaganda. Bless God, he had not run into Outstanding Karen. A fellow cardiotech, Outstanding Karen specialized in assessing blood flow throughout the body, even had a pressure cuff that would fit on your big toe. Her beauty was plain and wholesome, yet striking, like an actor in a Swiffer commercial. Long black hair always pulled tight in a ponytail. Clinic Scuttlebutt said she was recently divorced from a man who suffered from alcoholism and borderline personality disorder, leaving her with custody of two preteens whom Jerry was desperate to parent. His own marriage to Terry, may she rest in peace, had been childless. Jerry was hopeful because she always said hi to him in a fairly bright voice when they passed in the hall, as if in her 7 months on the job, she had yet to discover he was a dreaded truther. So Jerry was glad he had not passed her this particular morning because he would not have been able to refrain from stopping and talking with her to show how much he wanted to share his life with her. And then she might have asked him what he was carrying, forcing him to tell her his true thoughts about 9/11, which might have puzzled or alienated her. Or she might not have asked him what he was carrying, which would have been shattering in its own way. Jerry arrived at the intersection with Michigan Avenue, crossed with the light, and made a beeline for Alex, who sat at their protest table, on the front of which hung a black and white canvas banner that read, "Investigate 9/11." "Hey, Truther, what's going on?" Jerry asked, breaking a smile. "Not much, Brother Truther," Alex replied. "Just trying to jam a stick in the spokes of this imperial bicycle we're all riding." "Right on," Jerry said, nodding. The table was covered with terrifying, nation-saving DVDs, pamphlets, and bumper stickers, as well as Alex's bullhorn, which Jerry was not to touch, so Jerry dropped the papers with a deep thwap on the fancy brick pavement. The stack lost plumb and threatened to tip over. He corralled the top couple of reports and stabilized the pile. "That's what freefall acceleration will do to a structure," Jerry remarked dryly. He held out a hand, and Alex shook without getting up. Alex was a grad student instructor in the English department at Western. He wore a filthy gray t-shirt and a Detroit Tigers cap and had once told Jerry that this was how he dressed when he taught, too. For his part, Jerry hoped his clinic scrubs would lend the protest some first responder credibility. On this side of Michigan Avenue, the street became a pedestrian mall. Their table stood in the shade of a Kalamazoo Valley Community College building up against a concrete planter that encircled bunches of prairie grass, small rounded shrubs, and a pole topped with a limp American flag. Jerry picked up a clipboard with a sheet of yellow legal paper for recording email addresses and scanned the passersby for new recruits to the truth. But even during morning rush hour, prospects were sadly minimal. Two men and one woman in business suits carrying soft black bags in lieu of briefcases strode from the Radisson next door and ignored their table. A woman in a mobility scooter, her graying dreadlocks tied back in a great bunch, motored toward them across Michigan Avenue and kept on driving down the mall. Holding her large purse at her armpit like a soldier toting an M16, another woman walked right in front of them. As soon as Jerry said, "Excuse me, ma'am," she made a quick negative shake of her head. Jerry thought it was sad, all these people sleepwalking through their lives. He wanted Outstanding Karen to learn the truth about 9/11 when they were alone together, maybe after they'd actually started dating, when she would already know what a gentle and caring man he was, when he could invite her back to his house and play for her one of his architects and engineers for 9/11 truth DVDs. He wouldn't have to explain. She would see and understand. Unlike Alex, who said he'd smelled something fishy the moment World Trade Center Building 7 collapsed in what was obviously a controlled demolition late in the afternoon on 9/11, Jerry himself had been slow to see the reality. The Afghan war had tweaked his suspicions, but it wasn't until Bush invaded Iraq and it turned out Colin Powell had lied to the UN about the WMD that he realized how badly he and the entire American public had been played. Jerry wasn't always as certain as Alex, but he believed that, at a minimum, the evidence demanded a new 9/11 investigation guided by the most scrupulous application of the scientific method the world had ever seen. "Where the hell is Martin?" Alex asked. He stood up and began pacing in front of their table. It was 8:42 a.m., just 4 minutes before the time of day when American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower. Alex had scheduled the demonstration to begin at precisely the moment the government struck against its own people, just as he had every September 11th since 2002. While there had also been 10th anniversary protests in Milwaukee and Dayton this year, as far as they knew, the Kalamazoo 9/11 Truth Coalition, K9TC, was conducting the only city center protest in the entire nation. This seemed to put Alex on edge. Still, Jerry didn't feel it was constructive to get angry at Martin, the third member of K9TC, who had been unemployed for over 2 years since losing his job as a loan officer at Fifth Third Bank. Martin had two kids in college from his first marriage and another child from his current marriage that he had to get off to school today. Frankly, it was a wonder Martin hadn't already killed himself, and Alex would sure have egg on his face if he got mad at Martin for being late. And it turned out that Martin was in his garage at that very moment, slumped over the steering wheel of his RAV4 with the engine running. Just in time, Martin appeared around the edge of the Radisson, pushing a large black spherical cooking grill that was tipped back and rolling on two wheels. The light changed at the intersection, and the advance of traffic temporarily drowned out the rattle of the grill. "I made it. How about that?" Martin said. "World's got my nuts in a vice, but I made it." Martin was decked out in black dress pants, a burgundy shirt, and a tie patterned with paramecium shapes. "Speaking of F-bombs, what is your policy?" "It's all good." "You know why this is sensitive for me? Because of what happened." "Okay. Looking good," Jerry said amiably. "I know I look like a fucking idiot," Martin said, "but I'm trying to act like I'm employed, all right? I hate being up with the kid this time of day. Where is Daddy going? Daddy's going nowhere. Oh, wait, he's going to tilt at windmills because it's 9/11 again." "Jesus, Martin," Alex said, grabbing his bullhorn. "Let's start this demonstration on a positive note, okay?" "Thanks for bringing your grill, Martin," Jerry said and shook Martin's hand. "The pleasure is all mine," Martin said, with a strange open-mouthed grin. He briefly mugged a ranting face at Alex behind his back. "Wake up, Kalamazoo," Alex boomed through the bullhorn. "Wake up, America. It's 8:46 a.m. again on September 11th. A little over an hour later, after Alex explained via bullhorn how the South Tower had actually been brought down by thermite-based explosives planted weeks before by a black ops crew posing as elevator inspectors, Martin set fire to a copy of the NIST report that had covered up this very fact and dropped it flaming on the grill. While the report was still smoldering, a white SUV towing a stainless steel cart pulled off Michigan Avenue and onto the red bricks of the pedestrian mall, parking 15 feet in front of their table. "Guys, I don't mean to be paranoid," Martin said in a low voice, "but this is undercover cop written all over it." "Bring it on," Alex said, staring hard at the SUV. "I'd love to see them try to mess with our First Amendment rights." "Hope he's not towing a bomb," Jerry blurted. There were two propane gas tanks on the underside of the cart. "Holy cannoli," Martin exclaimed. "What if..." "Chill," Alex said. The door to the SUV opened and out stepped a guy Jerry pegged in his late 50s, red, short-billed, bald cap, khaki shorts, and a beer gut straining his yellow T-shirt. As he shut the door to his SUV, he flashed his small, pinched eyes in their direction. Moving laboriously, he unhitched the cart. "Perfect fucking disguise," Martin whispered. The propane tanks gave Jerry the willies. His wife had been killed in a freak propane explosion 9 years ago. A guy who couldn't sell his house had decided a gas leak could rid him of the offending dump and shower him in insurance cash. He rigged his lines and filled his house and garage with propane, then touched it off with a click of his garage door opener. The explosion sent up a fireball, and pieces of the house flew 100 yards. Terry was one street over, driving home from drinking with her girlfriends, probably singing along to some classic rock in her braying Chrissy Hynde voice, and a flying piece of gutter came right through her open window and hit her in the head. The guy who blew up his house was closer to the explosion than Terry, but he was unharmed, though he did end up in prison. God bless Terry with her penchant for drunken runs to Meyer, her over-the-top karaoke performances, her deep knowledge of Nostradamus. She had figured out that Stairway to Heaven was about Jackie O. It was obvious when she explained it. Jerry and Terry, Terry and Jerry, over, gone. The man began unloading his SUV, a white folding table remarkably like theirs, a huge furled red and white umbrella, a blue cooler, and a few insulated tote bags from Sam's Club that made Jerry think of the backpacks of the Boston bombers. "We're in the shit now," Martin said under his breath. They otherwise watched in silence. 10:07 a.m. came and went, the moment Flight 93 supposedly crashed, and Alex was apparently so distracted by the cart man, he had neglected his usual spiel about how NORAD, the government organization charged with maintaining our airborne national defense, lied about what it did during the hijackings. After he finished unloading, the man got back in his SUV and drove away. "I don't like it," Martin declared. "I don't like it either," Alex said. "Hey, maybe he'll draw more people," Jerry said, trying to tamp down his own anxieties. "They'll stop for food, and then we can fill them up with the truth." At 10:28 a.m., the moment the North Tower fell, Alex reminded everyone that Bush and Cheney refused to testify under oath to the 9/11 Commission. The cart man had returned on foot and seemed to pointedly make a racket while scraping his grill clean. The look of contempt the man gave them when Martin burned another 9/11 Commission report was unmistakable. "Got a question?" Alex asked the man. The man set up a metal stand to which were clipped bags of chips. "Just keep it down when I've got customers, all right?" the man finally said in a voice that was closer to a joshing plea than a threat. "Of course," Alex said. "It's more important for you to sell a hot dog than it is for the American people to understand the most significant event of the 21st century." The man just shook his head. "Trying to shake that sand out of your ears?" Alex asked. "Won't work if you still got your head in the sand." "Yeah," the man said. "At least I'm living in the real world." "The real world?" Alex asked. "The real world? And what do you see as reality, good sir? You think Fox News is giving you the real world?" "Who says I watch the Fox?" the man said, lumbering about his cart, avoiding eye contact. "Reality is that no metal frame skyscraper in the modern era has collapsed from fire," Alex said. "Reality is that the steel that should have been tested to determine the real cause of the collapse was whisked off to a landfill. No questions asked." "Let me ask a question," Martin chimed in. "What caused Pearl Harbor?" "FDR caused Pearl Harbor because he wanted us in the war to help Churchill. Did you know that Churchill lived at the White House during World War II and FDR saw him naked?" "Martin," Alex said softly. Jerry knew that Alex hated it when Martin lost focus. "I read it in fucking Doris Kearns Goodwin," Martin insisted. "FDR was meeting with the Japanese ambassador at the same time as Pearl Harbor. They shook hands on it." "Look," the man said, turning and facing them squarely, "I've got a permit for this spot. I paid good money for that permit, so why don't you take it somewhere else, okay?" "There you go again," Alex chuckled, "falling back on your rights as a capitalist. All property is theft, but I guess you don't want to know that either. Why don't you pull your head out of the sand? Seriously, tell me, why not?" "You're the one with your head up your ass." "He is one of the most well-studied experts on 9/11 in the country," Martin shouted, pointing at Alex. Alex narrowed his eyes, picked up his bullhorn, and boomed through it. "Wake up, old fool. Yes, you, by the food cart. You're an ignorant old man." "Hey," the cart guy said, and stepped toward them, brandishing his grill scraper. Jerry noticed that about a dozen people were milling around, watching the argument. A few had their phones out. Bless God, none of them were outstanding Karen. She was a model of politeness and calm at all times, brightening the break room with her smile, and on special occasions, her famous double chocolate brownies. But even though she wasn't physically present, he would prove his wisdom to her. He put up his hands and said loudly but calmly, "Sir, sir, how about you pick up some of our free DVDs and we'll buy some of your cheeseburgers?" I'm not a fool, the man said, his eyes lasered at Alex. I'm a good citizen. I watch CNN and vote and pay my taxes and do what you're told, Alex said. Listen, smartass, the man said, advancing toward their table with his grill scraper. Alex came out from behind the table and raised his bullhorn, which came within a foot of the man's face and made him instinctively pull back. Guys, guys, Jerry yelled, waving his hands.
Attention, all ignorant Americans, Alex shouted into his bullhorn. Wake the fuck up.
The man's eyes bulged. He rebounded forward and shoved Alex, who fell back against the table, tipping it and sending DVDs clattering onto the pavement. Alex steadied himself and the table, a look of crazed triumph on his face. Whoa, who saw that? He had never let go of the bullhorn, and now he raised it to address the small crowd.
Who saw that? Assault and battery, for telling the truth.
The man stalked back to his cart, threw down his grill scraper with a clatter, and aimlessly rearranged some plastic bags filled with buns. Go ahead, Alex taunted. Commit your violence, and then retreat behind your capitalist facade. Business as usual. No more business as usual, Jerry heard himself yell. This was a rallying cry from the early days of the movement, and he'd responded to Alex's cue mechanically. He wished he hadn't said anything. The cart man turned his back, hunched in furor, apparently trying very hard not to respond anymore. A minute later, Jerry heard the loud whoop-whoop of a squad car pulling onto the mall's brickwork, followed by a second unit. Each killed its bubble lights as it rolled to a stop. The people standing around parted, and three cops deliberately exited the vehicles while a fourth stayed in his car talking into the radio. Oh, God, now I'll never get a job, Martin cried. Jerry groaned inwardly. The TV news fans were sure to follow, and soon outstanding Karen would see his activism splashed across her screen. The police seemed acquainted with the cart man, of course. He was here every day, probably gave the cops free food. But Jerry knew that even a suggestion of conflict of interest could garner a billy club upside the head. Jerry heard Alex tell a cop, "Hell yes, he assaulted me." Jerry confessed to a different cop that while he had tried to mediate the conflict, he had accidentally yelled, "No more business as usual," which was not an attack on anyone present, and he was really sorry about it. Still, Jerry couldn't help adding, "Please, officer, I don't know who this sandwich man is, but could you please check those propane tanks to make sure they're not weaponized? I mean, it's 9/11. This could all be a setup." "We're on it, sir," the cop said, walking away. Jerry felt better for touching every base. Unlike most people, he took nothing for granted. So far, no reporters, probably kept away on orders from the police. He was relieved, yet a part of him craved to be on a more honest and open footing with outstanding Karen. Then the cops brought the cart man and Alex together. The cop in charge, with his G.I. Joe physique and military haircut, quickly got down to threats. If people couldn't agree to get along, the police were prepared to issue municipal disorderly conduct citations, which Jerry gathered was basically a big parking ticket, and another for violating the public burning ordinance. If people really wanted to stay ornery, they could arrest them on state disorderly charges and book them and let them explain themselves to a judge. He noted that the cart man had a permit while the demonstrators did not. Jerry was surprised when Alex just looked down and listened instead of defending their right to speak and assemble. Yes, there'd been contact, the cop went on, but witnesses said personal space had been violated on both sides. Maybe the demonstrators could just call it a day with warnings all around. Jerry saw through the fake reasonable tone. Government agents were once again trying to suppress the truth. Martin was literally biting a knuckle. Whatever you say, lawman, Alex said, trying to sound sarcastic, but the sting didn't carry. Come on, guys, we made our point. Let's pack up. Jerry was floored, but he couldn't bring himself to contradict their leader. For lunch, they went to a Greek diner on Michigan Avenue. Alex was introspective, and Jerry watched his mood carefully, keeping quiet himself. Martin was the one who wouldn't calm down. Churchill's nudity was totally relevant. Didn't you hear about the naked guy they arrested in Waterton during the manhunt? Looked just like Tamerlan Tsarnaev. The house-to-house searches were trying to condition us for the police state to come. With the naked guy, it was like, we will strip search you and parade you in public. Like I've always said, they're digging the basement for a much bigger building. Mark my words. I'm sorry, Martin,
Alex said wearily, "You've got a huge problem with confirmation bias. Every incident looks the same to you." "What's that, Mr. Fancy Words? What are you talking about?" Alex shook his head, as if deciding whether it was worth explaining anything to such a picklehead as Martin, and Jerry couldn't entirely blame him. Finally, Alex couldn't resist. "It's when you ignore evidence that refutes your hypothesis and pay attention only to evidence that supports it, like the 9/11 Commission did." "I know what I'm seeing," Martin said darkly. "Well, I've got our credibility to look out for, that's what I'm seeing," Alex continued. "Like I've said a million times, the Federal Reserve conspiracy, that's real. It's hiding in plain view. Oklahoma City, 9/11, Flight 800, totally clear. But the wing nuts going after Sandy Hook and Boston and Christ, the birthers, I'm sorry, Martin, I can't be dragged into that crap."
"Suit yourself," Martin said. Then he broke into that strange open-mouthed grin.
Jerry theorized that part of Martin's mind was broken, and this part sometimes came into play at surprising moments. Alex clearly worried about Martin, but the organization had shrunk over the years from 8 people to 3, and maybe Martin was a necessary foot soldier. He certainly had a good memory for conspiracy details. "So is that why you didn't argue with that chief of police?" Jerry asked. "We had every right to be there, and that guy pushed you." He couldn't keep the edge out of his voice. Alex picked up a fry and waved it back and forth like a metal detector over the remnants of his burger. "You know what? Maybe I'm tired of banging my head against the wall." He ate the fry. "Telling the truth is not banging your head against the wall," Jerry said, though he feared that was exactly what it was. "Amen, Brother Jerry. But I'm thinking a change of tactics is called for. Gentlemen, I have an announcement to make. This is my last 9/11 protest." Jerry blushed. He didn't know why. "You don't mean that," he said.
"I do."
"Listen," Jerry said, "that sandwich man just tells me we've still got a lot of work to do. They haven't quit in Oklahoma City. We sure as hell can't quit." In fact, a new DVD, A Noble Lie, had recently come out 18 years after the fact, detailing the government's complete foreknowledge of the Oklahoma City bombing and the subsequent cover-up. Martin just glared at Alex, gears grinding behind his eyes. "Look, I still believe in the truth," Alex said, "but the change we need is more fundamental than any of us have realized. We need to attack the bullshit at its roots, get at the way people think, not just change a particular thought. You can bombard people with all kinds of facts, but they're not going to accept those facts unless the structure of their mind can handle it. We need a consciousness reform even deeper than the one we've been trying for with K9TC. I'm telling you, I see it as clear as day."
"So what does that mean?" Jerry asked.
"I don't know what it means for you guys," Alex said, "but for me, it means writing a memoir with total radical honesty." Alex was getting his PhD in something called creative nonfiction, which frankly sounded crazy to Jerry. Now they were giving PhDs for making up facts? "It's just been hitting me that I was raised in the all-time worst and most typical mindfuck factory in America," Alex continued. "My parents are exhibit A when it comes to exactly how a mind can be poisoned by a structural defect. If I can just capture who they are and what they try to do to me, I could expose the whole insidious process for everyone to see." All Jerry knew about Alex's parents was that they had 7 marriages between the two of them across 3 continents, and both were serial adulterers, rampant narcissists, and soulless materialists. "Someone scooped out their authenticity with a melon baller," Alex once explained. Jerry stared at his half-finished tuna melt. It was not the best tuna melt he had ever eaten. He slumped back in the booth. Over the years, Alex had proven impervious to even the smallest suggestion from someone else, so Jerry had little hope of changing his mind about giving up protesting. "I'm going to call my memoir American Liars," Alex added with a flourish. "That's a good title," Jerry had to admit. The deep breathing Martin had been doing through his nose reached a crescendo.
"Yeah, perfect," he said snidely. "I can't believe I'm hearing this. I can't believe you've been judging me nonstop all this time, and now this bullshit. You goddamn quitter, you goddamn psycho quitter."
Martin slammed his palm on the table, making silverware jump and drawing eyes to their booth.
"That's it, I'm out of here."
Martin pulled out his wallet and threw down a bill.
Then he slid out across the brown vinyl seat and headed for the door.
Jeez, Alex said. Did someone just say psycho quitter?
He shook his head rapidly as if to clear it.
Wow, irony much?
Jerry looked at his watch. He had to get back for his 1 o'clock. Alex smiled weakly at Jerry. I suppose you're abandoning me too.
I know it's been an emotional day, Jerry said, looking into Alex's eyes. It's been a super emotional day for me too. We'll talk soon about next steps.
Alex chuckled incredulously. Emotion's got nothing to do with it, brother.
I've got to get back to work now, but we'll talk,
Jerry said, standing up. He pulled out his wallet. I'm thinking about what you said, all right? I'm not abandoning you or the truth.
Alex made a dismissive gesture with his hand that cut Jerry to the quick.
Jerry thumbed through his wallet. On a hunch, he looked down and saw that Martin had left only a single. He picked up his check and Martin's check and slipped them together and added a 20 to Martin's dollar plus another 5. It was a huge tip, but it was the least he could do for the working class.
Jerry walked down Burdick Street toward Bronson Cardiac Care with his hands jammed in his scrub pockets, scanning the sidewalks for outstanding Karen, who might be out for lunch. If the NSA hadn't been tapping his phone before today, they surely would be after that episode with the cops. He'd been waiting for the right post-divorce moment to ask outstanding Karen for a date, but obviously he could no longer call her unless he wanted to expose his beloved to government surveillance. How had it come to this? Jerry had assumed that Alex was a committed visionary, a truth movement star to whom he could hitch his wagon, someone who could get him access to the heavy hitters at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, men like Gage and Griffin and Ed Asner. Unfortunately, Cardiac sonographer did not meet their definition of engineer, so he wasn't allowed to sign on to A&E on that basis. But no matter, this wasn't about him or other trappings of prestige. In fact, after Terry's death, Jerry had assumed that K9TC offered him the most meaningful sense of companionship and purpose left to him in this world. He'd assumed that the unfolding disaster in Iraq would help his family and his coworkers see how right he was about 9/11, that they would at least read his pamphlets and watch his terrifying but informative DVDs. And even if they never woke up, he'd assumed they would respect his right to uphold his views. But his father openly called him crazy. His sister mailed back the DVDs in a Ziploc bag, pulverized into plastic grit. Some of his coworkers snickered when he walked into the break room. And now the movement itself was coming apart. Could he demonstrate with just Martin next year? Who would give speeches with the bullhorn? They'd have to buy their own because Alex was sure to take his with him. Terry had supported his participation in the movement, had admired his principles. Would he betray her memory by quitting? On the other hand, could he continue to risk sabotaging himself with outstanding Karen? For years, his loneliness had seemed a type of vindication, but now it weighed on him like 110 floors of rubble. Jerry re-entered the building via the back entrance, and who should approach from the other direction but outstanding Karen, looking incredibly cute, walking heel-toe in her running shoes and scrub pants, her long black hair pulled back in an extra tight ponytail.
Outstanding Karen, it's fantastic to see you.
He stopped, hoping she would stop, and she did. He was blushing from accidentally having used the secret form of her name. Still, he tried to read in her expression whether she had been out for an early lunch and had maybe seen the fracas with the cart man.
Ha-ha, well, you too, Jerry, I guess,
outstanding Karen said.
How are you doing? Are you having a great day and everything?
She laughed. You're a trip, Jerry. As she smiled, he saw the dark space behind her upper right incisor, where maybe a tooth had gone missing, but it was not quite a tooth-sized space. Or was it? He would ask her about it when they were more intimate. Feeling the rush of impending connection, Jerry plunged over the edge. Forgive me for prying, but your ex sounds like a handful. How are things back at the ranch? How's your spawn? She seemed to freeze. He could actually feel his heart pounding so hard that his chest hair was padding ever so slightly against his shirt. He was stunned by all he had said to her.
Oh, I don't know. Her smile faded, but she didn't seem mad at him. Things are okay.
Jerry mentally blessed her for not being offended.
I'm sorry, he said. I went too far. I apologize.
Hey, I heard someone say the police broke up a demonstration by the Radisson, she said, gracefully changing the subject.
Oh, really?
Jerry said, trying to keep his voice even. Some 9/11 protesters, give me a break. Politics makes strange bedfellows. What do you mean? She squinted at him. We must stand up for our beliefs, Jerry thought. A marriage built on lies of omission cannot stand. I mean, we all must together wake up from the bed of sleep, he managed. The light faded from outstanding Karen's eyes, her brow clouded. No doubt she was reminiscing about her borderline disordered ex-husband and whatever mad rantings his condition had produced. Here before her was another deranged man. Okay, well, got a 1 o'clock, she said, and started walking away. Have a good one. Have a great one, Karen, please. Jerry headed to his office, shrouded in gloom. Clinic scuttlebutt would no doubt soon establish that he was at the fracas, on the side of the dreaded truthers, harrying the lone wolf capitalist cartman. When she heard this, she would stop greeting him brightly. Her eyes would slide. She might stop greeting him at all. Or maybe the situation could still be saved. Maybe he could confess to her that he had lost his way, that his wife's death by freak accident had made him paranoid beyond reason. But he was better now. He could see clearly again. And would she like to go out to dinner with him? In other words, all he had to do was lie to her. When he greeted his own 1 o'clock, he did a double take. Joseph Brancusi was a heavy man with a puffy face, wearing a faded logoless ball cap, a lot like the cartman. How's it going? He asked Mr. Brancusi. Can't complain, Mr. Brancusi said with a broad smile. Jerry led Mr. Brancusi back to his windowless office. Over the years, he had made it his own. He had hung a brown and gold W banner for Western, where he'd been a sociology major and played bass in several rock bands before he'd gone for sonography training. There was a small fish tank in the corner. He kept the room low lit, and he liked to play music from his desk computer while he performed his exams. Before going out to meet Mr. Brancusi, he had put the Rolling Stones' Some Girls album on shuffle, as he sometimes did, because it had been playing at the party when he met Terry. Now Mick Jagger sang about a girl with faraway eyes. This song in particular seemed to be about Terry, the only woman he had ever convinced to love him. But this time, it was too much, and he had to go over to his computer and turn off the music. Then he confirmed Mr. Brancusi's birth date and asked him what was going on. Not much, Mr. Brancusi replied. A little short of breath sometimes, climbing stairs. Otherwise, I'm good. Jerry had a bad feeling and asked Mr. Brancusi to take off his shirt. He had him lie face up on the blue examination bed. He attached 3 electrodes to the burly torso and then had him turn onto his left side with his left arm over his head and his right arm resting on his hip. Gravity had its way with Mr. Brancusi's soft flesh, melting him down. Brancusi closed his eyes and exhaled as if settling in for a nap. Jerry seated himself near the bed at the keyboard of his Mindray DC-7 ultrasound system. He put a bit of gel on the probe and placed it between the 3rd and 4th intercostal spaces on the chest. And as always, just like that, he was able to see into a man's body. All at once, Jerry came back to himself. He no longer felt inept and alone. He started with a parasternal long-axis view of the heart. The left ventricle lay on top of the left atrium like 2 throbbing sausages. Right away, he noticed a fair amount of pericardial effusion that manifested simply as dark space. Not good. The mitral valve and the aortal valve opened and flapped shut quickly, alternating in a sort of call and response. There was calcified vegetation on the mitral valve. The left ventricle was moving somewhat chaotically. He took measurements. He recorded stills and short movies. He viewed other cross-sections of the heart, which, from all angles, worked hard, if somewhat wildly, struggling in its confined space like a man in a gunny sack. Meanwhile, the patient lay relaxed and still, like a normal man in his own bed on a Sunday morning. Jerry saw a terrible disconnect between the patient's desperate inside and his clueless outside. He had vaguely noticed this during other exams, but today, this disconnect seemed to represent the most profound truth, an aspect of the structure of consciousness like that which Alex was hoping to reveal in his memoir. Sometimes there was trouble in ourselves we could at best only dimly sense on our own, but not actually see, because we didn't have a reliable instrument
that would allow us to stand apart from ourselves and then look back into ourselves with scientific detachment. This disconnect was incredibly pathetic and sad. It was why the great mass of humanity would never, ever see the truth about 9/11. In truth, the patient's heart was not normal. It was sick, congestive heart failure in progress, and Jerry's report would make that clear. That's it. Do you guys do Q&A or not? Okay, if you have questions, I'll be happy to. Yes.
So that was so incredibly detailed and just a wonderful world and a wonderful point of view.
Well, thank you. I just come out and say it. My brother's a 9/11 truther. He really believes it. And his situation is complicated. He was a heavy, heavy pot smoker for decades. And I think it's taken its toll. So he really believes this stuff. And it was hard for me to get into this story because I didn't want to write about my brother. And I had a lot of anger about it because he would bombard me with stuff. And it was a big, big conflict between us. So I couldn't write about him as the truther. And it wasn't until I found a more genial, aw shucks, naive voice for the truther that I said, I can find a little edge of humor in this and keep all of my more, why, what, you know, when your own brother seems insane to you, it's just, you love him and then he's insane. Anyway, so I needed to do that. So in the process of engaging my brother, I did end up learning a lot about what truthers think about what happened on 9/11. So that's where a lot of the detail about the thermite explosives and that sort of thing. So I didn't research it for the story, but he would send me these big dumps and he would send me DVDs. And so I did research that. And then I live in Kalamazoo, so the settings there worked out. And then I had some heart stuff done, and which was totally unrelated. And I just said, oh, I'll make this guy a heart person, because I thought that, I think sonography is pretty crazy. It's just amazing. They can really just look in there and see, you can see your own heart beating on the screen. It's so wild. So that wasn't researched for this story, but once I had it in my head, I kind of just wove it in. Kind of a long answer, but it is kind of like how a bird builds a nest. You know, you got a little Snickers bar, and you got a twig, and you got some gum, and over a while, you just sort of put all the, you make a nest. Yeah. I won't answer every question at such length, so you don't have to worry about that. If there's my brother in there, he's maybe closest to Alex. So that may be something. But it was funny because those three guys came to me really fast. I just knew how maybe triangles are easy to figure out because you kind of exaggerate this direction, you exaggerate this direction, you exaggerate this direction, and then I love triangle character situations because they're so unstable. If you have a group of three friends, how many of you have, like, is that your core friend group? You know, it's never stable because one leg of that triangle is always bonding slightly more than the other leg. And I love that that creates sort of a swirling dynamic. So there's moments when Martin's defending Alex. There's moments when he's really irritating him. And then Jerry is always trying to be the mediator and be everybody's buddy. So, yeah. Yes?
I thought the comic kind of twist that Alex decides the only thing he can do now is write a memoir about himself was really interesting. Where did that?
That, I just think it's really, I know some of you might write memoirs, so I don't want this to come off weird, but I think it's true of fiction writers too. You're in your own head and you're trying to engage the world through your own perspective. And sometimes you can get carried away with the extent to which what's going on in your head means something to the rest of the world. You know, and Alex really takes that to an extreme where he says, my lens on my family is like the key to what's wrong with America, you know? And so I love the grandiosity of that. And I don't remember where that came from. But I'm an academic, and so, you know, the creative non, there's all, we were talking about, there's poets, there's fiction writers, there's creative non people, and they all have their ways of sort of like playing with each other a little bit. So I don't know, I shouldn't have said that, but yeah. I thought I'd mess with him.
That's interesting. I don't have a question, but a comment. But it's interesting the way that plays off the stenographer, right? Two different angles on truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. More scientific and more subjective.
So. Yeah, and I think that's another thing that you can get carried away with the conceit of your expertise. So he has his pretensions to scientific objectivity because of the work he does, but he has such enormous blind spots that no matter what he's observing carefully, he's going to miss other things. So I love people who have pretensions to expertise. They're great, you know. They're fun for stories. Oh, you want? I don't know. I mean, I try not to think about it because if I try to do anything, it doesn't really work. So I almost like, I think I'm afraid to try to make a joke in my story. So I always want to have it super dry so that if they don't get the joke, it's okay. But if they get the joke, it's okay too. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.